We want to thank y'all for tuning in to Running Up the Numbers.
Every Monday at 8 a.m. And if you miss us in the morning, you can catch the replay in the afternoon at 2 p.m. and again at 8 p.m. You can also catch the shows archived over at thenumbers.fm.
Make sure you're following us on all social medias, because we out here. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, House Party, YouTube, Twitch, Black Planet, MySpace, Tinder, my favorite, Google Plus.
In this episode, we'll be putting you up on Costco updating their mask policy, developments in the Ahmaud Arbery case,
the latest COVID-19 updates and resources, featuring an interview from the Numbers Zone, Charlisa Shadowbox, with Rachel Banks, Public Health Director of Multnomah County, and developments with latest stimulus proposal,
and a newsletter that provides coronavirus news for Black folks. But first, let's take a moment to remember Andre Harrell. Andre Harrell, music icon, the founder of Uptown Records, has passed at the age of 59. The news was first announced by DJ D-Nice during an IG Live set Friday night. The New York native began his career as an artist, one half of the duo Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Not too long after that, he was at Def Jam making executive decisions. In 1986, he went on to found Uptown Records, home to acts like Guy, Teddy Riley, Al B. Shore, Heavy D, and Jodeci. Another act you might be familiar with is Mary J. Blige, who was developed and released on the label by Sean Combs. It was during his stint as an A&R at Uptown that Puff came across Biggie's demo tape. Apparently, not too long afterwards, he was let go from the label and started Bad Boy Records. Harrell later moved on to television and film projects, including New York Undercover and Strictly Business, while still maintaining his label over on MCA. By the time 1995 rolled around, he was the president of Motown Records. One of his latest projects included a miniseries about Uptown Records being developed over at BET. His contributions to Black entertainment are immeasurable. He will definitely be missed.
All right, and up next, we got Charlisa Shadowbox interviewing Rachel Banks. Tune in for these latest COVID-19 updates and resources in this interview.
All right, hello, and we are live. I'm Charlisa Shadowbox Harris, and I'm a media personality on the Numbers Radio of Out the Box with Shadowbox. Thank you, Rachel Banks of Multnomah County Health Department, for joining me today and giving credible information to our community here in Portland.
It's my pleasure. It's great to be here.
I appreciate it. So let's just go ahead and get right into the resources and into the questions, and that way we can make sure that we answer plenty for our community. First of all, let's start with, how would you describe the county's initial response to the COVID-19 crisis?
Yeah. So our response, I categorize it in a couple of ways. One is that we, in our overall response, are trying to lead inclusively with race and also be working with communities for culturally specific strategies. There are things that we know that no matter who you are in Multnomah County, you need in this time of response. And we also know that there are unique needs related to Black, Indigenous, and people of color as well. And so what we've done is try to start the disease, who's most at risk from getting the disease, or if they do get it, from having serious complications. So that's our elders, that's people who are living in congregate care facilities. And that was initially how we began the response. And then acknowledging we needed to add Black, Indigenous, and people of color as a vulnerable and prioritized population because of some of those underlying health conditions and the disparities that we face there that are based on our experience with racism that are based on structural and systemic injustices. So a state of emergency is used to allow whatever government, so the state of Oregon in this case, or in the county has one as well, to act in a faster way. It allows us to get resources out the door quicker, to move things around quicker, and to acknowledge that you can't, it's not just business as usual, we need to move faster. And so extending a state of emergency is not the same as the stay at home order. What it does is it allows the state or the county to continue to draw down resources, so to draw down federal resources, to continue to be able to act more quickly and more nimbly in the response. The emergency declaration, the state home order, could be in effect that long, but really what I've heard the governor's office talking about is phases and what needs to be in place before it's safe to reopen.
So there's a possibility that it could extend until July 6th, but based upon how well, should I dare to say that we do with the stages, it could potentially be done sooner. We could potentially have that change sooner.
Yeah, the The phases have to do with, there's a number of things that need to be in place and that need to be in place by the region. Here in the metro area, though, we have a lot more people. And so I want to acknowledge it's not the same picture of what's happening in Eastern Oregon, for example, where the cases are low and that sort of thing. But there's a number of things that need to be in place. Our hospitals need to have enough capacity that if people get sick, that they can go there. Because what we know is that anytime those physical distancing measures are released, people will get sick. We want to make sure that we're able to protect vulnerable populations. So whether that's folks in long-term care, whether that's our Black, Indigenous, and people of color, that needs to be in place. And there needs to be a sustained decrease in cases or hospitalizations. And those are the things that need to be in place before we could start to loosen up on the physical distancing. And those things would also need to be maintained to move from one phase to the next to the next.
Got it. Okay. So from what I see, it definitely depends on us being able to be compliant as well throughout these stages in order for it to be effective. Right.
Did you say, let me make sure I caught that, that people need to be compliant?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, how the disease spreads does depend on folks' ability to stay physically distant. I want to say, though, that I know that that's easier for some folks than others because of where you live, because of what type of job you do. Those are things that we take into consideration as well.
Right. Okay, that totally makes sense. So then with the new alarming projections indicating a spike in cases nationally next month, what measures do you anticipate having to take in the near future?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing that we're focused on is making sure that we have all of the right things in place before we start talking about loosening up physical distancing restrictions. That's a hard call, though, because, and we also understand how devastating it has been, the loss of business, the loss of income, the loss of our cultural practices. We know the impact that it's having on our faith institutions. So there's really these trade-offs there, and it's a hard conversation. And that's the conversation we want people to start having, is thinking about what those trade-offs are. One area that I'll talk about is something called contact tracing. And, you know, I'm sometimes asked, like, what are some of the myths, or what do you feel like people need to know? And so if somebody tests positive, we follow up with them to figure out who they have been in contact with, perhaps where they got the infection, and to try to identify other folks who got the who might have been exposed, and so that we can follow up with those folks. We do it, we get the information about positive tests from the lab, from the doctor's office, or sometimes people call us themselves, and then we follow up. But so one thing, and especially if you're you know, like us, it's like, who from the government is calling me, and how'd you get my information? And so we want people to expect that that's going to happen. If you have a positive test, that we're going to follow up with you. We're going to call. We're going to ask for to confirm your date of birth, and start asking questions. And we need to expand that workforce, and we're going to expand it in a culturally specific way. So on our website, which is, if you Googled Multnomah County COVID or COVID-19, you could get onto the website. And one of the things that's on there is a resource request form. And so there's a variety of resources that we have, from, you know, sanitizer and coverings and other things. So that's one place to go. And I think in that, it's best to roll up requests, and we're trying to work with organizations so that a whole bunch of individuals aren't having to make requests, but really look at what are the Black serving community-based organizations, and what does it look like to pool a request for, let's just say if it was, you know, face coverings or sanitizer or whatnot. We do have things that people have donated to us that we're able to get out. So we have our community health centers, which are open. So 503-988-5888. I hope I didn't mess that up. If not, it's 5558. I'm gonna write that later. But anyways, I can follow up with you on that. That's one thing. And they're accepting patients. We operate behavioral health services, including culturally specific behavioral health services, and have a crisis line. So if folks are feeling like they need someone to talk to, we have a crisis line. We have resources for folks who are experiencing
just really a struggle parenting their children and finding that it's harder to, there's more tension in the parenting relationship, that there's more tension in their relationship with their intimate partners. So we have resources to help folks work through that as well.
That was a piece from Charlisa's interview with Multnomah County's Public Health Director, Rachel Banks. The interview will be available in its entirety on our website later this week. So make sure you're following the numbers on all social media for updates. We've also added some clips of the most crucial parts of the interview and added them to our regular schedule. So keep it locked right here on the numbers. Mask up to get it popping in Costco. Back on May 4th, Costco required that you started wearing a mask just to shop. To be clear, you're required to wear a mask before entering the store. Initially, they were only going to apply this to select stores, but they've made this nationwide. With this requirement in place, Costco has reported that most of their stores in the U.S. and Puerto Rico will be returning to their normal business hours. They will be offering special shopping hours for people over the age of 60 between the hours of 9 a.m. and 10 a.m. Costco will also be limiting the number of people allowed in the store at the same time, in an effort to make it easier for shoppers to adhere to the current social distancing standards. Moving forward, only two customers will be permitted per membership card, except in El Paso, Texas, Kentucky, and Puerto Rico, where they'll only permit one customer per card. First things first. I don't know about this whole 9 to 10 a.m. shopping for the elderly, for the people over 60. Like, I feel like they need something like in the middle of the day.
Nah, they be up and going way too early. They be up at 5:14 a.m. opening blinds, moving pots and pans, doing they laps.
Facts. Yo, you know what? You right on that one.
Yes.
Somebody will argue. You definitely right on that one. And then what's up with, El Paso, Texas, Kentucky, and Puerto Rico? Only one customer per card. Like, are these smaller stores? Like, I don't understand.
Yeah, and so, I thought about that a little bit. And the only thing I can come with is maybe the idea that these are more rural-type locations and the amount of people bum-rushing those Costco doors is a big one.
Good point.
That's all I got for it.
Yeah, we'll check back for updates.
And now, a newsletter started by Black columnists that provides updates for Black people about COVID-19. More than ever before, it's imperative that Black people have accessible alternatives to information. The current COVID-19 crisis reportedly kills more Black people than any other race. Fortunately, one Black columnist has started a weekly newsletter. Speak Patrice presents Coronavirus News for Black Folks, a distribution committed to keeping Black people up on the most recent news, including the COVID-19 crisis. Patrice states, "As a Black woman and freelance journalist passionate about writing stories for us, I've been desperately brainstorming constructive ways to lend my writing skills to help suppress the coronavirus disease and pandemic. At the same time, for a long time, I've been wanting to write more original stories independent from any publication for my own audience and to start a newsletter as a way of practicing that. So I decided to combine all these ideas and dedicate my newsletter, Speak Patrice, to highlighting coronavirus news for Black folks, both stories written by other journalists and by me, Patrice Peck. The bulletin will include three stories per week that highlights various sources of information related to coronavirus and its impact on people of color, also helping to mitigate the distortions in information because Black people need reliable platforms that they can count on. You can check out the newsletter for yourself at speakpatrice.substack.com. How you feel about that, man?
Yo, listen, that's real talk. Us needing reliable sources of information is crucial right now, man. It's too many people out here juggling conspiracy theories and taking things on their own on their own merit.
They did one search, they clicked one link, went to YouTube, and they got it figured out.
Bruh, here's the thing. I'm not going to sit here and say I read every single thing that I see on the internet.
Righteous.
But when there is a post that pops up and the headline is so crazy, the first thing I do is Google that same headline or that same information to see what other news sources is popping up with it. If it's, bulletinboard.net,
look,
and aroundthecornernews.com,
with a Z,
news with the, yeah,
yes.
come on, man.
Like, every time.
You got to do a little better.
You know, some things is risky. I equate that to, like, I don't necessarily trust people with, like, a Hotmail, you know, email still at this time. So you just gotta vet your sources.
Listen, you gotta chill. You got you throwing darts at me. I still got my Yahoo. I still got my Yahoo email, bruh. I use that for, like, you know, coupons and you know,
okay, valid
discount valid. Stuff like that. You know, yeah, I still got my. I don't got.
But you're not sending quotes out from the Yahoo.
No. Okay. No, I absolutely am not.
Well, I'm glad that that's you've gotten updated.
Listen, so yeah, to be clear, if y'all get an email from ambush at Hotmail, it's not me.
It's not.
That's another Nigerian trying to scam you. It's not me. Promise.
Scam Beezy makes an appearance. But I'm going to jump into this new stimulus proposal that could start out with $2,000 and $1,000 per month thereafter. Another stimulus bill proposed by two House Democrats would bless all Americans with $2,000 and then $1,000 monthly for a full year after the coronavirus pandemic is under control. This new benefit would be distributed through a preloaded card. The idea is that by using a preloaded card, it would guarantee that every individual, regardless of immigration status or debt, will receive the assistance. Cash can be withdrawn from the cards and they'll be accepted wherever credit and debit cards are currently used. Americans with permanent addresses will receive their cards in the mail. Those without will be able to pick up their cards from a bank or credit union. The bill also makes provisions for members of the elderly or at-risk communities to receive their cards via emergency responders. These deliveries would also serve as wellness checks. I really like the way this is laid out, sir.
Straight up. This is boss. I mean, this makes it so people, you know, in the houseless community can just go and get assistance for real, man.
Yes.
I love it. Yes. I love it, man.
I agree.
Straight up. More arrests coming in the Ahmaud Arbery case. On what should have been Ahmaud's 26th birthday, it was announced that more arrests may be on the way in the unarmed shooting which resulted in his death back in February of this year. Vic Reynolds, the director of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, took the time to explain his decision to swiftly apprehend the two primary suspects in the case. On Thursday, Gregory McMichael, 64, and his son Travis, 34, were charged with aggravated assault and murder. The McMichaels are being held in the Glenn County Jail as per GBI public statement. Gregory McMichael is a previous investigator with the local district attorney's office. When pressed about additional arrests, Reynolds' response was, "Don't know yet. We're going to go wherever the evidence takes us." Cell phone footage posted online not too long ago, which captured the shooting, started national outrage and calls for arrest. "We're investigating everyone involved in the case, including the individual who shot the video," Reynolds said. The Thursday evening capture of the McMichaels, who have said they were acting in self-defense, tops off the last few days of speedy developments in the Arbery case. It was at a standstill for nearly 2 months as the head prosecutors recused themselves from the case. Gregory McMichael told police that there have been a few late break-ins in the area and that while in his front yard, he saw the individual he suspected from those burglaries running down Satya Drive towards Buford Drive, as per the February 23rd Glenn County Department incident report. The McMichaels pursued Ahmaud, and the rest is captured on video. Arbery's family is viewing this as a modern-day lynching. His aunt Thea Brooks told GPB News that although the arrests were being celebrated, she feels that there is still a long way to go. "This is only the beginning," she said. "We still got to wait for the conviction." Because Georgia is one of four states that don't have hate crime laws on the books, there will be no hate crime charges. NAACP President Derek Johnson is quoted as saying, "The sad part of this is that the attackers felt that they were within their right of white privilege and protected by the color of law because one of them happened to be a former law enforcement officer. This is part of an ongoing systemic attack on African Americans by law enforcement and vigilantes."
Dog. You know, that quote by Derek Johnson, the depth in that statement, just feeling that they're within full right. There was the word fear pops into a lot of these type of scenarios, right? Fear runs away, not towards that.
Right.
You know what I mean? And this case clearly shows somebody being confronted.
Right.
And what really bothers me is the comfort that these people felt in confronting.
Right.
They're not officers of the law. Mm-hmm. Citizens, civilians. I don't care what your past career was.
Affiliation is, right. Right.
This just, there's so much that could be said. And
yeah. Yeah. I mean, but you nailed it, though. Fear is the excuse that they constantly use. But it's clearly evident you're hunting someone. How are you hunting someone out of fear? That doesn't jive. But, you know, it's consistent with the excuse that they use in every single situation.
Yes.
It's the same excuse, you know, law enforcement uses, fear for my life. Yes. Fear, no matter what, everybody's out here scared. Yes. You need to stay in the house.
Yes.
Stay in the crib. I mean, that they described it perfectly. This is definitely a modern-day lynching. Mm-hmm. One of the prosecutors, or one of the district attorneys, when everything initially happened, mm-hmm. because she had a friendship or relationship with, I believe, the father, mm-hmm. Who was one of the investigators, former investigator, she put a halt on the arrest when it initially happened. Like, there are so many people that are culpable. The fact that the video never came out, there are so many heads that need to roll on this. So, you know, we'll stay up on this and be covering this from week to week. We gotta stay focused.
Definitely.
Straight up.
Betty Wright has passed away at the age of 66. The 70s music icon invested her vocals into R&B and soul. Wright's niece shared the news via Twitter on Mother's Day, Sunday, May 10th. Wright's most popular songs included No Pain, No Gain, Where Is the Love, and Tonight is the Night. Her 1972 single, Clean Up Woman, will be memorialized when it was sampled for Mary J. Blige's remix of Real Love. Going down in hip-hop, soul, and history. Her riff from Clean Up Woman has created a lifelong legacy as the cut has been sampled by other artists including SWV, Sublime, Willie D, African Bambaataa, and Chance the Rapper. Her first hit, Girls Can't Do What Guys Do, was later sampled for Beyoncé's Upgrade You. Wright began her decades-long musical career at just 12 years old when she secured her first record deal. The Miami native, born Bessie Regina Norris, began topping charts in the early 70s with her hit song Clean Up Woman that landed her the number 2 spot on the R&B list and earned her an RIAA gold record. She went on to release more than 10 top 20 songs. The 6-time Grammy nominee won her first and only award in 1976 for her song Where Is the Love. Wright proved herself to be a consummate collaborator who worked with a long and varied list of artists such as Marvin Gaye, Bob Marley, Lil Wayne, and The Roots. In recent decades, she continued to contribute to the music world and share her talents by serving as a mentor to younger artists, including Jennifer Lopez and Joss Stone. Just last month, her legacy was honored on TV1's documentary series Unsung, which highlights some of the top R&B and soul artists over the last several decades. We send our condolences.
Yo, I'm definitely going to do a Betty Wright deep dive on Tidal or whatever streaming platform, YouTube. I definitely got to, man. Like, that's crazy.
I was just listening in myself, and it must have been at a live show, and the way she was talking and interacting with the crowd, and she was performing Clean Up Woman, and mm-hmm. she was just going back and forth, and you could just feel that people were identifying so much, you know, and just singling people out like, oh, you smiling right now? Well, we're going to wipe the smiles right off your face. I was loving the energy. So, when you do that, let me know. If you put together a little mix or something, slide it on over.
Yeah,
I mean.
Challenge accepted, brother.
Yes.
Challenge accepted. Yeah, we might need a little mix of all three of their contributions.
Yes.
Okay. All right. You put me on task.
Another news, Little Richard has passed away. ABC News tweeted, breaking, Little Richard, the self-proclaimed architect of rock and roll, has died. He was 87. We'd like to call out the disrespectful nature of this tweet and remind everyone that erasing the achievements of African Americans is a founding component of systemic racism. These attempts at whitewashing history cannot go ignored. Little Richard's contributions aren't black history, they are American history. He's a founding father of rock and roll and should be respected and treated as such. His stage show set the standard for decades to follow. Born Richard Wayne Penniman on December 5th, 1932, in Macon, Georgia, he was one of 12 children and grew up in a very religious family. And even though he sang at a nearby church, his father, Bud, wasn't supportive of the time he spent singing secular music, which resulted in him leaving home and moving to Macon at the age of 13. After winning a string of talent shows, he landed his first record deal at RCA in 1951, and soon afterwards would forever be known as Little Richard. In the years leading up to his passing, Little Richard lived in Nashville and still performed here and there. He only performed sitting down, but his rock and roll spirit was ever present.
We'd like to close this out with an Instagram post from @NifMuhammad. In 2004, when Rolling Stone did its 100 Greatest Artists of All Time issue, they assigned other music legends to write about the tributes to their peers. Elvis Costello wrote about the Beatles, Robbie Robertson wrote about Dylan, and so on. Little Richard was the only one that opted to write about himself. In his tribute to himself, he was somber and reflective, weary of shouting into the halls of history about what he'd done and what he was owed. He lamented the fact that he was ranked below people who wouldn't exist without him. And he was right. There were people who were dismissive about Richard writing his own tribute, but what he was also saying by doing it was that it was impossible for him to be praised by a peer. Little Richard was peerless. Not in a general sense either. I mean that he had no peers. He had no equals. For years, those who tried to live up to his standard fell short, and those who could have honored his legacy fell shorter. Richard was not only the first seed of the first tree in the forest of rock and roll, he was also the very earth itself, the sky all the other trees grew towards. Anyone who has listened to me talk about music for more than a little bit of time has probably heard me work Richard in somehow, with gratitude, of course, for the fact that he was still with us for so long, but also because I know he never got what he deserved. I love Little Richard a great deal, and this one hurts a lot. If you'd run into Richard in Nashville towards the end of his life and talk to him, he'd sometimes mention how much pain he was in. He'd give you a pamphlet about heaven and deliver a small word about God. I hope history does better for Richard now that he's gone, and I'm sad and a little angry that it didn't when he was here, articulating his greatness for decades. Please spend some time with his legacy today, if you can.
Well, man, we've done it.
Yeah, first episode down. Knocked it out.
Well, make sure y'all tune in with us every Monday at 8 a.m. to p.m. and again at 8 p.m. as we sit down and run up the numbers.
Boom. All right, y'all. Catch you next week. Run Up the Numbers, hosted by Ken Jones and DJ Ambush. This episode also features Charlisa Shadowbox and Rachel Banks. Special thanks to our researchers and writers, Shireen Hassan, Sham Shawan, Hannah, Alicia, and Joseph Watson. Edited by Jonathan Covington-Brem. Music by Seeds.